it's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey.
So you're back from Salt Lake City.
Flew in last night.
Did you make it, all those people behave nice and share their toys?
Oh, that
you're going out there as a bridge builder.
That was not my job.
Civility stuff.
The civility stuff, yeah. It was a conference, did some speaking at, and then we did a half day of a post-conference thing that I mediated, trying to get people to describe what would a political environment look like that tried to respect people involved in the conversation. And
I can't even picture that.
Well, what's funny is it really feels like, you know, Don Quixote hopping up on your donkey to go beat a windmill with a stick. But because, I mean, even the comments are made, you know, this is really idealistic. And we're going, yeah, it is. I guess it is idealistic. We're looking to help reshape how we debate in America. And I think we're at a low ebb of our national politics. And it's not because there's conflict. It's not because people see things differently. It's how we treat people who see things differently. And Sarah and I just watched that John Adams series. It was on HBO that Tom Hanks helped produce. I don't know if you had a chance to see it.
We
rented the DVDs and just kind of worked through it this summer. I had a ball. I mean, there was one point where in France in this garden one afternoon, John Adams is sitting down with Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin. And they're just talking about this new country that they've started in America. It's about 7-8 years old and it's struggling to exist. And I'm thinking, well, what would you have paid to be in that conversation? Man, I tell you what, that would have just been to hear.
That is fascinating.
To hear those three minds talk, particularly in the course of the miniseries, you see how much Adams and Jefferson are at each other's throats. They really see this government differently. I mean, Adams is much more of a federalist, and we need a strong government so people don't kill each other. And Jefferson is much more the rights of the individual and government being distant and minor and not the important influence. And at the end of it, the last, it was an interesting quote, probably from the book that the series is based on, but the quote was this. In the end of it all, it seemed that John Adams was polar south and Thomas Jefferson was polar north. And the tension between them produced a statement of democracy that made sense. And I thought, boy, that's a great way to look at that conflict.
Huh.
Each pulled and pushed the other, but because they stayed, parts of the relationship broke up even for years at a time, but in the end, they stayed friends. And what most people don't know, these two guys died within hours of each other on July 4th, on the 50-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence.
Really?
Incredible. And at the end of their lives, they had this great friendship that they'd shared through letters. But, I, you know, thinking about that and thinking about what we're trying to do in Utah and trying to stimulate a better conversation, one of the guys said this, you know, we're talking about respect. And unfortunately, in our culture, people seem to think, I respect you when I respect your opinion. And if I don't respect your opinion, I don't respect you as a person, I can vilify you and lie about you.
That's good to clarify. That's true.
Yeah. And we don't see respect as, you know what, I respect the liberty of your conscience. That's a lot of what Bridge Builders is. The environment we try to help school districts develop is, it's not the school district choosing your point of view over mine, whether it's sexual orientation, morality, whether it's curriculum issues. We don't have the school as the broker of the public morality or the broker of public dissent. What we do have, hopefully, is schools that say what we champion here is the liberty of conscience. That's what we champion here. You, as an individual, have a right to choose to live your life. And I think this is so gardenish. This is what God did in the garden. This is what Jesus talked about in the gospel. You have the right to be an idiot if you want, to believe what is untrue and to live your life around what's untrue. But what we uphold is the liberty of conscience. You have the right, as just because you're a person, you have the autonomy of self that allows you to make decisions and believe what you believe. And you can be wrong about that. What you can't do is be destructive about that to other people.
See, I think that's a little bit of what I start to get concerned with when you look at the agenda of, and I don't want to just pick on, quote, the Christian right, but it's almost as if there's that sense of the crusading, we got to bring America back to its Christian roots. And it's like, I think its roots were freedom.
Yeah.
And liberty of conscience. I don't think the establishment of religion.
Well, I think that was the ideal. But, you know, for the first 2,000 years, we practiced a Protestant Christian view of liberty and freedom.
Exactly.
And we gave the rights of freedom to the Jewish people to have a synagogue or to, you know, we gave the freedom of religion to other people. But Christianity, a Protestant Christianity at that, controlled all the forum. And so we had this great ideal, all men are created equal, but it only counted if you were a white, male, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant landowner. It didn't include women, didn't include other races. And I think the American ideal is, how do we spread that to an ever-expanding group of people? But what that means is this country moves away from this Judeo-Christian ethic mooring that some people think we had at the beginning. We did. We had a unified, and it wasn't even a Judeo-Christian. That's been added to make it sound like multicultural. It was Protestant Christianity that ran the day. And the first guy to talk about this, you know, they say it was the first one to even use the language of separation. It wasn't Thomas Jefferson in the Danville Baptist letter that everybody quotes. It was Roger Williams, who said, we don't have the right. You don't have the right to ask someone to act in deference to their conscience, that the conscience is the thing we uphold more than all. And he said this, in its best day coercion, and I think religion is all about coercion, whether they can do it now through the state or whether they do it through the letter we read on the last podcast. This guy's having doubts about being part of this fellowship, so they've turned his daughter and wife against him. And I mean, coercion, here's a quote from Roger Williams. On a good day, coercion brings hypocrisy. On a bad day, coercion brings rivers of blood. And this is a great thing. If I'm going to coerce you, if I have the power to make you act the way I want you to act, then I can make you a hypocrite. But if I can't make you a hypocrite, then I've got to kill you. And that's what Roger Williams is saying.
Well, I got friends that, you know, they passionately care about the moorings of America. And it's like they want to bring it back to its Christian roots. And it's like, as nice as that is, I just don't think you can force that. And so they would look at me, and perhaps my opinion on this is, oh, that slippery slope of, oh, my gosh, he's backpedaling from where his passion used to have. And it's like, no, I don't think so at all. I do think, in quote, in the simplicity and purity of simple devotion to Christ, why don't you let people discover how awesome he is? If you force them, you're going to almost preclude them from being able to discover that.
Yeah, which is that's a Salvation Army kind of thing, which I love their whole deal of, if we're going to win America, we have to win America one person at a time. You don't get to skip the conscience and change law and make people conform. You've got to make a different case than that. And if you want to win people, if you want to win the nation to Christ, you do it because you've won people by this compelling reality of who Jesus is, not because you amass enough political power to make the rules.
And I sort of feel like when people have their agenda, you know, like I'm gonna force my belief structure onto this whole group, and I'm doing it with good intentions. You're just going like, I think the very execution of that is not going to produce good results. Because if it's going to be forced upon, that seems to be very contrary. I don't see Jesus anywhere in the Gospels walking through time and space and the history of relationships. I don't see him forcing his way.
No, that's the point. Well, I do bridge builder trainings, and I've done it at times for Christian universities, their ed management schools. And I'll say, I can teach you what I want to teach you about this liberty of conscience and living together with a sense of mutual respect that transcends our differences of belief. And I can do it two ways. I can do it through the First Amendment, because it's there. Or I can do it through the ministry and example of Jesus, because it's there. And which do you prefer? And they almost always go, both. We want to understand both. Because most people really, I think our religious constructs and what we've gotten from religious institutions over time is, religious institutions give people the power, and in the name of accountability or whatever, to coerce people to act in ways they wouldn't freely choose to act. And we think somehow that's the gospel. The gospel is, I've conformed you to the rules of Christ without inviting you into a relationship with him. And what Paul says is, the rules will never be good enough. We can't keep the rules. We couldn't keep God's rules. How are we going to keep each other's rules? And even if we're trying to codify God's rules into law, you can't make people conform to what they don't freely choose. And here's Roger Williams. We talked about him earlier. I love this guy because he's living in a culture that's 95% his worldview. He's in Puritan New England. And he's a pastor in Puritan New England. He starts talking about, you know what, we don't have the right to make non-Puritans among us live like Puritans. And his argument
that video
was
real popular.
he got exiled in the dead of winter. He got
really?
He got defrocked.
What a shock!
Worse than happened to you and I. He got removed from his pastorate and sent out of it in the dead of winter. He walked down to rode down to what's modern day Rhode Island. Established a colony there, and the base of that colony was liberty of conscience. And here's the beauty of it. He said, I'll argue with you all week long in the legislature that you have a right to your belief no matter what it is. And then on Saturdays, I'll be down in the town square telling you why you're wrong and why the life of Jesus is the only answer there is. Now, that's a guy who gets it. Coercion never works. And his argument was this. When you try to coerce somebody to believe what they don't believe, you have asked them to act.
You're increasing their resistance.
That's what he said. He said, you alienate them. You don't endear them to the God you love. And I say that all the time with the bridge builder, whether I'm with Mormons in Utah, with gay rights advocates in San Francisco. I'm honest about where I come from philosophically and the beliefs I live around. But I get to have great conversations with people who disagree with me because they know I'm not trying to coerce them to my faith. I invite them to my faith, but I'm not going to coerce them.
See, I think that's where people have the disconnect. You even look at how they want to use hierarchy and authority. It's like, again, I think it's for coercion. It's for manipulation. It's like, I can pull rank on you,
I get
you to do what I demand because you have to be submissive to my authority. It's like, you know, parents, when they do that to kids, they don't win their kids' hearts, and they don't produce lasting behavior.
No, for sure.
You pull rank, and frankly, yes, can you? Sure, go ahead. What's it going to get you?
You can until they're 12, 13, or 14. Then they figure out there's a lot they can do behind Papa's back they'll never see.
That, you drive them there.
You do, absolutely.
And so I sort of feel like, gosh, when you're not there appealing and gentleness to someone's conscience, where what they give you is something that's free and uncoerced, the value of what you get is little, if you get anything in that. When it comes as free and voluntary, the profound reward is that really means something because they had the freedom to choose it. I look at that and I don't see God pulling rank. I don't see God using coercion because I think he's desiring that same love relationship. I think he's longing for us to see him as he is and to fall madly in love. If you forced someone to do that, if you were the agent that forced that, would you ever get the reward of someone's love and affection and know that it was real?
Absolutely. And that, isn't that the point of the whole Luke 15, the parable of the prodigal or incredible father? You've got this kid who wants to go out and make no good, and dad pays for him to go. Here's all the money you want. Go. Is that not freedom? We were talking the other day on the phone about someone giving the license to sin. That was one of the arguments about grace. And your comment, I thought, was hilarious. But when someone says, you know, you're just giving people the license to sin. And do you remember how you responded?
No, I forget.
Maybe I was talking to somebody else. I thought it was
your
point. But what you said was, didn't Jesus already give him that? And it was kind of a mind bender for me. I went, hold a minute. I'm not sure I can get my head around that one. Didn't Jesus give us the license to sin?
Oh, yeah. No, I totally agree. Yeah, I do. I think we do. We have a registered license to sin. All of us.
I'm not sure. In the sense of freedom,
all of us have a profound license to sin. As in, we can. And it's like, okay, well, what's it get you? I don't know that I want to use my license. Just because I can doesn't mean that I now think that that's wisdom or smart. But I do know it's there. I can choose. I know this from a little kid. I can bop the guy next to me on the head. I can. Someone might try to stop me, but I can. And I'm probably quick enough that if that's what I want to do, I'll do that. It's not, God doesn't like stop the heartbeat right there.
Right, and it's not. It doesn't mean he stops the consequences, because you still get all that.
Well, you speed on the highway, you get an award. I got myself an award.
An award, you say?
No, it's the same one, not a new one. But you look at that, and it's like, people are, oh my gosh, are you going to get it? It's like, I don't think the argument about releasing people to the liberty of their conscience really should do anything about, well, don't we need to control them against sinning? You can't. You really can't stop the inner decisions of the heart. You might constrain the outward behaviors of a body, but you can't. And the whole time, Jesus is looking for truth in our inward parts.
Yeah.
And so if you don't allow for a reality of going like, look, let's exalt the fact that God's really looking for true, eternal, lasting change that starts from the inside out. If the way I think I'm going to get our culture there is to put their outward in a straitjacket, I think I've made the job harder.
Yep. Some guy wrote me this week about The Shack, and he'd said, you know, I'm an editor for this particular publisher. I've been an editor 15 years and understood you helped edit part of this. Well, you didn't edit it enough, because here's this line he quotes about, you know, I'm not about following rules is one of the things that I think Jesus said, or Papa. And he said, of course it's about following rules. And he quoted the, you know, if you love me, you keep my commandments. And I wrote him back and I said, wow, you really missed that, I think. I think what Jesus is saying is, if you love me, if you get the loving down, you'll keep my commandments. They'll take care of themselves. The emphasis on that is the loving, because the whole gospel is about that. But I said, even if you want to take it legalistically, if you keep my commandment, his commandment was that you love. That you love like you. This is a new command I give you. Forget everything else. Here's the new one. Love like you've been loved. And by, so even if I take your interpretation of it, the command is still not fulfilling a list of rules. It is loving. It is loving like you've been loved. The problem is most of us don't know that we're loved. Therefore, we don't live like we're loved. And because we don't live like we're loved, we do all kinds of stupid things to ourselves and others that God calls sin. But the I was just thinking about that license coming, because that really bugs me. I hate to think I'd give anybody a license to sin, and I really hate to think that Jesus would, or that God did in the garden.
But I still think we have one.
But if it was just a license to sin, then the prodigal father would be saying in the parable, well, if you must go, go, but don't expect me to pay for it. That would be the license. Go ahead and go. It's even worse than that in the parable. Here's the money.
Yeah, here's the car.
All you need to get into as much trouble and destroy your life as you want to destroy it. And somehow at the end of that, I hope you realize who I am and come back to me.
But he never even says that.
No, he doesn't say that.
I think that's the thing that is so outrageous to me.
Yes.
He gives him the card and the money and the means and the blessing to go for it. And you're just going like, and he isn't sitting there saying, but I know you'll come back. You're just going like, I think that's the thing that most people don't realize I think about the heart of God. Is he lives in absolute security of being. I think he knows who he is.
You think?
I think. I don't think I'm on shaky ground there.
Have you ever tried to threaten him, you won't do this or believe in him if he doesn't do his deal? Do you find God incredibly defensive about stuff? I never have.
No, I don't.
I never have.
But I do find some of the most religious zealots to be very much needing to take care of that for God.
Yeah.
As if he might be insecure. And you're just going like, you know what? I think that's the disconnect for me. Is it doesn't seem like God has the same concern as a lot of the religious folks I know on the issues of rules. You know, when I look at all the rules, do I want to say that living right matters? Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think there's a reason Jesus is saying, I'd like you guys to live this way. I think because it not only will bless me, it will bless and touch everything around me. I think there are profound, ugly, awful consequences to sin.
Absolutely.
Okay? So there's nothing inside me that's wanting to say, yep, go for it. That's it. That's a great way to go. But I do think that, you know what? When Romans says, whatever is not done of faith is sin, you're not talking about the bad behaviors anymore.
You're really not, because you can follow the rules in fear.
And that's sin.
That is sin. I tell you what, there's just no way to convince some people of talking about right now.
Oh, that's
but
fine.
I think it's the absolute truth.
But I mean, to me, that's the ultimate leg sweep on everything, where it's like, it isn't about the rule keeping. It's about the relationship. If faith comes by hearing and hearing the word of God, which wasn't the Bible, it was the voice of our Lord. If that's where faith is born, then this thing called following Jesus can only be done in a relationship that is the fruit of a dialogue where he's directing my steps and I'm listening and I'm responding. If you take this outside of a relationship, your little righteous principles
and
are not going to guarantee that you're not living in a biblically defined arena called sin.
And you cannot read Paul and not get here. Because Paul is, you know, it's for freedom that Christ has set you free. The only thing that counts, it's all Galatians 5, is faith expressing itself in love. Nothing else counts. It doesn't matter what rules you're following to, you know, escape the flames of hell.
He had a lot of stars on his chart.
Well, he did earlier. He kind of ripped all those off and tossed them away. But I tell you what, there's so much of how it is that we get to live in God, which is liberty opens the door for real relationship. Real relationship opens the door for real righteousness. Not this plastic, follow the rules with this malicious, condemning, disrespectful behavior to other people. We watch a lot of pushback on The Shack now or some of my other books that's riled up people. It amazes me how they'll just make up stories. Well, Paul is from this Hindu ancestry family, and the name Sarayu was to bring people into a Hinduism New Age kind of motif.
Yeah. Now, wow. I didn't know that.
You know, you read that stuff about other people you don't know, and you go, gee, well, that's bad. When you know a person.
And you know what they've written.
Well, what you know is somebody just makes that up. Somebody makes up the first guy that makes up the story. Lots of other people might repeat it. But somebody sits down and says, you know what? I think the only reason you could use that is this must be true. And so then you create a false thing. And get back to the political debate. Our whole political discussion right now in America, I think, is at its lowest ebb since I've been alive. Not because people disagree about substantive things. A disagreement doesn't bother me. What bothers me is we have to vilify the opponent. Let's make up whatever you want. One of the guys said yesterday in a meeting, we're negotiating languages, what does respect mean? One guy says, you know how I define respect? You assume the wisdom and goodwill of your opponent. Now, what kind of discussion?
I've never seen that.
Wouldn't that be great, though?
Would be great.
I think in the bridge bill thing, that's what you do. You go in a room and you assume, okay, no one's in here because they're trying to destroy America. Everybody's here because they really have a heart for making a better America.
See,
people are going to disagree as to what that is.
But you would hear what they say through a different set of ears.
Yeah.
I mean, Kelly and I were talking about some stuff the other night, and she's asking me, you know, why do you think that is? And it's interesting. 2 years ago, I probably would have ventured an answer. I would have answered for that other person why they did that.
Right.
Today, I just find myself more often than not saying, I don't know. Because I know enough, I know more now to go, I don't have a flipping idea. I can come up with whatever conclusion I want, but the truth is I don't know the inner workings of that heart so clearly that I can just define for them why they're doing what they're doing. I can see the inconsistency. I can understand some of the pressures on either side. But the truth is I now recognize I have a greater hunger to ask them and hear what they actually say as opposed to decide for myself why it is that.
Because when we do that to people who disagree with us, we assume the worst motives.
Oh, we do.
And we make them
vilify them.
In concrete, yeah, because now, well, it has to be this. It is. And all of a sudden, it's a reality. And I love Paul's thing on this, 1 Corinthians 4, where he says, I don't even know what motivates me. Why would I guess what motivates you? God.
I don't even judge my own heart.
I don't even know how to get in there. I don't even know that I'm right. I know someday I'm going to stand before God where every motive of my heart's going to be revealed. And I tell you, if you have that kind of humility, if I don't know what my heart is leading me to do at times, why would I venture a guess about yours? It'd just be nuts.
Well, Jeremiah says the heart is deceitfully wicked, and part of me wants to go like, look, the part I'm concerned about is not the wicked part.
Yeah.
It's the deceitful part. It means I can fake myself out.
Yeah.
And you think of all the, I think we have supernatural powers of rationalization. And I think you look at all the things that have been justified in the name of following God, and you're just going like, how in the world did we ever get to some of the places we did with the thought that, well, I'm serving, and it's like, you know what? I think we can fake ourselves out. Wisdom starts to look at the fact that I could do that, and I need a guide and help, Lord. Please navigate me through the recesses of my own decision-making. What's governing me? What are those impulses? And I think, you know, to me, it's like when you put this life in the context of freedom, and I start to see Jesus for who he is, there's a sense in me that starts to go, oh, Lord, it's not safe for me to be, quote, by myself. It's not, oh, I got it, I'll take it from here. I just go like, wait a minute, I need a guide. I need your help. I do want to lean on you, not because I have to, but because I think the outcomes are going to be far better than if I was doing this on my own.
Yep.
And it isn't fear. It's if I get that help for free, I want it.
Yep.
You know, I look at his desires for me and I trust God's eternal perspective on the what I'm doing to be far better than my selfish self thinking this is the choice I want.
Right.
It's like, wait a minute, I kind of think he wants a far better outcome for me than just my little wish list.
Maybe that's the lie of religion, which isn't even the wish list, but even the rules list. The lie of religion is a person is better off being forced to act right than they are being invited to be real.
Wow.
That's the lie of religion.
Say that's worth repeating.
That somehow we benefit people by forcing them to act right, even in opposition to their own conscience, then we are inviting them to be real and out of that reality see what God does. So I think when the language of our declaration, go back to Thomas Jefferson's words, all men, it should have included women, everyone is created equal. Now, I think that's as godly a statement as can be made. But the first time it was made was in 1776, 1700 years after Christ lived on the earth. Up until that time, it was all about men who had power to coerce others to act. The idea that we're all created equal and are endowed by Creator with certain rights, and those rights have to be guarded by the state, not trumped by the state or by power. That's something that took culture 1700 years to get, and now it's fairly well known in the culture. It's still not known in the religious cultures of America, where we still have the clergy-laity distinction, the whole idea that some men get to be rulemakers and force others to follow the rules is what ministry is all about, instead of, I'm to introduce people to a Jesus who's changed my life so that Jesus can change theirs. The thing I wrote back to this publisher guy was, this editor guy, I don't think our outcomes are any different. My outcome is still, I want people holy, shaped in the image of God, living in the world. You think rules will get you there, and I think you've got to miss the whole New Testament to embrace that. What I'm telling you is, relationship will get you there. You'll follow all the rules, and if you want to, you know, the great freedom chapter, Galatians 5, I just talked about, is for freedom that Christ has set us free, and love fulfills the whole law. So get the loving right. The only thing that counts is faith expressing itself. In that chapter is the greatest list of the deeds of the flesh in all of Scripture. And if you haven't read that list in a while, read that list. It'll expose so much of your own heart that I don't, oh, that's sin? That, yes. But the answer is not, well, then do the opposite of all of
them. There's all the rules that'll keep you from that.
The answer is, I've got to learn to follow, which is Paul's answer. I've got to learn to live by the Spirit and not fulfill the desires of the flesh. But it's the living by the Spirit. It's living inside this relationship of love. It's from the freedom of knowing I don't have to act any way towards God, but I want to enter into a relationship with him that will then transform me.
Well, you think of the fact, if you're keeping the rules because you think God's a bean counter and it takes so many good acts to get that certain blessing, or that somehow then obligates the Almighty to bless you, because I've behaved, I did your rules.
That's right.
If that's what's governing your behavior, as opposed to stepping behind that and saying, gosh, I wonder who has the better desire for my life.
Right.
The guy who made me, or the me who's still trying to figure out who I am?
Who is so broken by his own self-preferring nature. Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's like, I kind of go like, honestly, I've made a shift where it's like, Lord, I kind of trust your decisions for me better than I trust my own. Because I've recognized when I've reached out for selfish interest, maybe I had the power or the means to manipulate to get what I wanted. Most of the time, it didn't turn out as great as I thought. There was a huge consequence
all the time
for my getting it that way.
Absolutely.
Okay? Now I recognize, gosh, Lord, it is so much more secure and enjoyable beneficial on every level when I get something that you've given to me on your time frame, under your terms, of however that's come about. When I know that it hasn't been the fruit of my hand manipulating something, gosh, I can live in such a way that that thing doesn't own me. It could go away tomorrow. I didn't bring it. I can't keep it. I don't have to control it.
I don't have to protect it. Exactly.
And it's like when you look at that, you're just going like, gosh, that way of living life, because I have drank from both wells,
yeah.
I go, oh, Jesus, yours is so much better. I really have lost the taste for my own selfishness as thinking that somehow is going to lead me to the wonderful green pastures I dream about. You're just going like, you know what? I'm pretty sure that's going to lie to me at some level.
Yeah. And what I wish the religious crowd could get their head around is that that kind of life and transformation has to begin with a spirit of freedom. Freedom is not the end result.
You can't get there any other way.
Freedom is not the end result. Everybody needs to be free. Do whatever they want to do. That's what you guys are saying. No, we're not saying that. We're saying you are free to do whatever.
You do have a license.
But that'll give you an – you don't have a license. You have a blank check. Well, not a blank check. I guess it runs out. But you have a check. So go. But hopefully the whole discovery in your freedom and the chance to be real is you get to see how ugly real is when it comes out of your own brokenness,
exactly.
And shame and hurt.
And it goes back to the fact that when you're talking about how, you know, some people believe that we should, you know, not let someone live in their freedom. We've got to control their behavior so they don't do. You know what happens? You stop that learning process. You keep someone from the inner workings of their heart and the outworkings of their life so as to learn the fruitlessness of that endeavor.
Yep.
You don't change it. You imprison it. You restrain it. But you don't ever transform it.
And then religion is just another act. I've learned to act the way I'm supposed to around you. But
yeah,
in my closeted moments, the real me comes out that I've learned to hate, that I've learned to despise. And so people who live religiously live in this conflict between
self-hatred.
Yeah, it is, because I can't perform well enough all the time. I can sometimes, so it proves I can do
and
it.
I'm told that these things and impulses are all bad and evil and wrong.
Yeah, and because I never have gotten them into the light. And that's First John. Unless if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we'll have fellowship with him. And I used to think that meant perfection. Walking in the light means, well, I've got to be perfect because I'm not perfect. But then the very next phrase from John is, and he who says he's without sin is a liar, makes God out to be a liar. So then, you know, walking in the light doesn't mean I'm perfect. Walking in the light means I just got my stuff in the light. So me and Jesus get to work on it together so that I can find freedom in a real unraveling of myself. And the fact that what I'm doing because I don't know that he loves me. So I don't trust that he has the better deal in mind for me. So I've got to go out today and earn my way into the whatever it is I want. And I think what you were saying earlier about, boy, what the love relationship does with Jesus more than anything It's that you don't come to this theological conclusion, God knows best about everything. You come to the real, practical reality. He really does. And wherever I wander without him, trouble awaits. And wherever I wander with him, good things happen, even if it's in the middle of trouble and strife and horrible stuff.
See, I think because religion has been so much an issue of people's evaluating each other and then just ascribing, well, if you don't perform well enough, then you don't have value. I think because there's so much of that comparative worth that's always going on, you're not empowered to live in the light. Because if all of a sudden something ugly reveals itself, well, then I'm terrible. I have no value. Whereas opposed to if we're supposed to live and walk in the light, when all of a sudden something ugly emerges, the available transformation is, oh, God, did you see this on me?
Yeah.
Do you see? You better do something.
Yeah.
This is ugly, Jesus. Please change this in me.
Yeah.
Where it has nothing to do about all of a sudden I am more or less value. It's more like, oh, gosh, Lord, this is here. Could you take care of this?
This is where the community we live this out is so important. if the community you leave this out in is a community of actors, so that when something ugly comes out, everybody pretends to be shocked because we really don't know what's in each other's closets. We really believe the illusion we're all living. These guys that we met with from Arizona, the True Face guys, you know, they got this guy going into what they call, this is two rooms to go into. One room is the room of striving to be all God wants me to be. That sounds so right, but you get killed in there. And the other room is trusting Jesus to be all who he is. And this guy goes into that room, and he asks the Holy Spirit, well, how are you doing? And he says, well, I'm doing fine. And it just seems so hollow in the room of grace. So he finally just begins to pour out his stuff. And he thinks he's being so blood-curdlingly honest that, you know, the whole room's going to be offended. And when he's done, somebody in the room, back of the room, shouts, is that all you got? I just think... See, now, what community are we going to live out transformation? If the community is a community of rule keepers, we'll become actors and hiders. If the room is a room of grace, we can all be authentic. Hey, struggle with yourself. That's all you got? You haven't got anything more than that. You're not struggling. Imagine that as the community in which people grow up. And for the last 10 years, I would say that's where Sarah and I have gotten to grow up. We've gotten to be with people who you can say, hey, this is what I'm struggling with, or this is what I'm fighting, or this is the thing in my life that I'm battling. And in the conversations, nobody's shocked. Everybody realizes we've all got stuff Jesus is unpacking. And the people that are in the least state of health are those who pretending they don't.
Yeah, and if this isn't lived out in, quote, the liberty of conscience, where it's like, you know what, you recognize, I can if I want to. If it's not lived out there, I don't think you ever discover what's really in your heart.
Yep, you don't get to walk it out with God.
And so I don't get it changed, because I think the way it gets changed, it doesn't happen without me. It seems that the process I'm aware of is that something gets revealed because something happens, and all of a sudden recognize, oops, I was a part of that. And I then take that to Jesus, and something marvelous
gets to happen.
Gets to happen as far as gets changed. If I'm always hiding that, none of it gets changed.
That's what the rule keepers don't get. It makes us seem like, oh, you guys are not firm on holiness. Oh, my gosh, I am.
Is this just a different way to get there?
Holiness is the only way I want to live. But I know holiness is not keeping the rules. It's being transformed by him. And that's what I want.
Traveling with us on the God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.